Hello and welcome to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. I'm Beth Shank, long-term host of the podcast, with guest hosts Lika Robb and Christina Watkins. Today they discuss the new Annie PFAS toolkit and interview a nurse leader who has used it, Paloma Greenwald. This is a terrific new tool for an emerging health problem. Please read about them in the show notes. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Christina Watkins, a nurse practitioner and current Johns Hopkins DNP MPH student. I'm here today with Lika Robb, a public health student at the University of Rochester. Lika and I are honored and excited to work with the Alliance of Nurses for a Healthy Environment, or Annie, during this fall term. For those who have not heard of Annie, it is a nursing organization focused on the intersection of a healthy environment and health. In this podcast, we will give a quick overview of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals. Then we are going to highlight two states, Michigan and Maine, that have experienced widespread PFAS exposure and what residents of those states are dealing with regarding PFAS and their health. After, we're going to introduce a PFAS toolkit put together by Annie for clinicians to help guide clinical assessment and decision-making. Last, and probably the most inspirational part of our discussion today, is that we will share snippets of an interview done with our Annie member, Paloma Greenwald, and her experience utilizing the toolkit.
So let's jump into our first section. One of the most pressing environmental issues we face today is that of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals. These are a group of over 12,000 synthetic chemicals used in a wide range of products because they resist heat, water, grease, and stains. You'll find PFAS in everyday items like nonstick cookware, water-resistant clothing, food packaging, and firefighting foam. They can also be present in drinking water and subsequently spread throughout a community. Unfortunately, they don't break down easily in the environment at all, which is why they're called forever chemicals. PFAS can accumulate in water, soil, and even our bodies, where they pose serious health risks over a period of time.
Now, PFAS have been linked to many different harmful health outcomes, from obesity and high blood pressure to lung disease and some cancers. And according to a T.H. Chan School of Public Health study that looked at over 7,000 community water systems from 18 different states, our communities of color and of lower affluence see a 10 to 108% increased risk of exposure to PFAS from drinking water for every industrial, military fire training facility, or airport within that community water service watershed. Pregnant and lactating women require higher intakes of water and thus also face higher exposure to PFAS. From breast milk, foods, and just because they like to put things in their mouths, infants and young children are at higher risk of exposure and may be more susceptible than adults. Coupled with their projected long lifetime, their exposure risk is compounded. To be clear, though, the benefits of breast milk still greatly outweigh the risk of PFAS exposure for breastfeeding infants.
So one of the most well-known PFAS contamination sites in Michigan is the former Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Oscoda. Wurtsmith was once an active military base, where firefighting foam containing PFAS was used for decades during fire training exercises. This foam seeped into the groundwater and local waterways, contaminating drinking water sources in the nearby Au Sable River. The community of Oscoda began raising questions about contamination back in the early 2010s, but it wasn't until recent years that more comprehensive testing showed just how widespread the contamination was. Residents of Oscoda have been drinking and bathing in water tainted by PFAS for years without knowing the full extent of the health risks. And this has led to many significant concerns, as PFAS has been linked to thyroid disease, kidney cancer, and other serious health conditions. Even now, efforts to clean up the contamination have been slow, and many in the community feel their voices aren't being heard by both state and federal authorities. Some families have even had to relocate due to fears of long-term exposure, which not everyone has the opportunity to do. This site has become a major example of how environmental hazards from military activity can leave lasting legacies that affect public health for generations.
Thanks, Lika. My heart goes out to all those affected in Michigan, especially to our military families who already sacrificed so much for us. Now let's turn our focus to Maine. I love Maine. I have an aunt who has a beautiful lakeside property just outside Demarscotta that I've been fortunate to visit a few times since COVID. It really has been a special place and was really special for us during lockdown, where we could finally have some open space. So when I think of Maine, I immediately picture a beautiful, rugged coastline and a large, vibrant forest. It truly is America's vacation land. Unfortunately for residents of Fairfield, Maine, that dream turned into a nightmare when the community learned that much of their water was contaminated by PFAS. Maine's Department of Environmental Protection had discovered PFOS in an on-farm milk sample in June of 2020. As many as 40% of the wells in the area tested positive for PFAS in 2021. These PFAS were traced back to Maine's paper industry, where these chemicals were added during the production process. Then, starting in the 1980s, the state began encouraging farmers to use sewage sludge as fertilizer.
Well, that must have sounded like a good way to reduce waste and use it for something useful.
That's what people in Maine thought too, until they learned about the enormous amounts of PFAS within the sludge, much of it coming from paper factories. Okay, Lika, these stories make for a great Hollywood movie, but as a clinician, is there anything out there that I can use to help answer questions for my patients that they might have about PFAS? How do I even know if my patient is at risk for high exposure?
Sure, Christina. A significant update came from the EPA in March 2023 when they proposed a new rule under the National Primary Drinking Water Regulation to limit six specific PFAS chemicals, including PFOAs and PFOSs. The maximum contaminant level for these chemicals in drinking water is now set at just 4 parts per trillion, which is an incredibly low threshold. And this reflects the serious health risks associated with even the tiniest amounts of PFAS exposure. This is a big step because these limits are enforceable, and water systems will be required to take action if these levels are exceeded. In terms of clinical practice, the PFAS toolkit from the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments is an invaluable resource for clinicians. It provides practical guidance for assessing PFAS exposure, testing, and patient management. One key tool is the PFAS Exposure Assessment Questionnaire, which helps clinicians determine if patients are at high risk for PFAS exposure based on their living environment, occupation, or consumption of contaminated water and food. This questionnaire can be easily incorporated into routine screenings and can guide further testing and follow-up. The toolkit also emphasizes educating patients on how to reduce their exposure to PFAS, such as using water filters and avoiding certain products, and it provides resources on testing for PFAS levels in the blood. It's a great resource for both clinicians and patients to navigate this very complex issue.
That questionnaire is really helpful. I bet it's something that could be even incorporated within clinic EMRs, for instance. Now, let's say that I have a patient that is positive in their screening. What kind of tests are available, to see what their levels of PFAS are?
That is a great question, Christina. Once a patient has positive screening for PFAS exposure, the next step is to determine their PFAS level through blood testing. Currently, blood tests for PFAS are available, but somewhat limited. Laboratories can test for several of the most common PFAS compounds, including PFOSs and PFOAs, which are often found in contaminated water and products. However, one challenge is that not all healthcare providers are familiar with ordering these tests, and insurance coverage for PFAS testing can vary widely. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention offers PFAS testing as part of its National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, but individual testing is not yet routine. Several commercial labs do offer testing, though it can be costly for patients without coverage. The results of the test can provide important insights into potential long-term health risks, especially if patients have been exposed over a long period of time. The data from these tests can also help guide monitoring and treatment strategies for managing PFAS-related conditions, such as thyroid issues or elevated cholesterol.
That is really, really helpful. Hopefully, more tests will be available soon and insurance will start covering this testing.
Next, we interview Paloma Greenwald, who has successfully used the anti-PFAS toolkit. Enjoy.
Can you tell me a little bit about your nursing career, you know, what your practice is like now and things like that?
Yeah. So I think it actually goes a step even before being a nurse. I've been a military spouse for 30 years. And so I went to nursing school for 7 consecutive years full time because they moved us and the nursing schools wouldn't accept any transfer credit for the actual program. So I feel really strong. I've got med surg down, right? But anyway, so I did ultimately graduate in 2000 and I did start in neurocritical care. And I transitioned into, when I had kids, I transitioned into complex case management. And that's also at the same time, remember, we're still moving through different military installations, but the global war on terror basically started after 9/11. And I took nursing jobs that fit my single parenting while my husband went through his 9 deployments. I'm very, very much a bridge between the local community and the military community. Okay, so I end up trying to just pick a schedule that works with my life, but I have to maintain my nursing license. And so I did a lot of community health, public health. I was a public health nurse for 6 years. I also consulted on aging. I'd have clients that needed to access their long-term care insurance and I needed to qualify them for having their claims accepted. And so I would consult with them on what it was going to take to age in place and the costs and all that. So I still do that, but very rarely. And in post-COVID, maybe during COVID, I just felt like we were missing the mark as a profession by not directly engaging with policymakers and taking on the mantle of whatever it was going to take to influence policy and not just be on the receiving end of it. And I got a master's degree in political communications so that I would be skilled at lobbying, grassroots organizing, coalition building, earned media, all the ways that we can build political will so that our elected officials are acting on our choices, on our behalf. So that's when I shifted and took less and less work individual as a clinician and did more policy work and incorporated it with my like capstone project and all of that. And then, of course, in January, or sorry, February, I was able to get to DC, but I've had between that and I do the same work for military quality of life issues, I've probably had 6 or 7 lobbying events this year that I was able to engage on either topic. And then I told you that certification for the elected officials. And actually, tomorrow night, I have a red eye to New York City to do an immersion training with the UN on climate change. So it's awesome. If I can pitch this notion with them, whoever will listen.
Yeah. I think that's great. Like you said, that our military is very broad reaching all over the globe. And but I really think it speaks to nursing that you know, are that bridge. And I think that's where we are especially placed as nurses, that we're that bridge between the community. We know what's going on in the community. We're seen as advocates for the community. And then thankfully that you have the courage to take that next step, to move to the policy realm and to put a little bit more power behind that voice. And I think a lot of nurses have, they just don't, we don't use it yet.
And that was a lot of the effort that I put into in my formal academic studies, because I think nurses in particular have really consistent barriers to entry in this type of advocacy work. And look, I recognize it's full disclosure. If I have this loud of a voice, it's because I have privilege. And not all of us have that luxury. And yeah, I think we have to be sensitive to that and maybe not burden an overworked community with even more. So I try to balance it. I try to do what I can, where I can, and still maintain credibility, not just outwardly, but within my own community. Because nurses are a discerning bunch. Also from the webinar, that I watched is we don't have to be the perfect geological experts or water quality experts, whatever. Like, we know the impacts on humans at the basic level. And those are our experiences that I don't think anyone's tried to refute. I live that. Those are my patients. Those are my community members. It wasn't I've never had anybody confront me as though I weren't being sincere or whatever people are afraid of.
And no one really cares about the exact level of contamination that they're exposed to. It's the fact that they are, just that they are, and that what is being done to help protect them, I think. And I think that's where you come in, where we come in as advocating for those who don't have the time or means to do.
Yeah, but I had to hear it 10 times from Annie. I did.
Yeah.
We want to be everything.
But I love that you said that. Yeah, we want to be everything. We want to know everything. We never feel confident enough. I think there is definitely a imposter syndrome kind of thing within nursing. I'm really glad that you found the webinar and the toolkit helpful. It's nice to see you in the work does something good.
Yeah, and everybody has, I think, their niche. Most people seem to want to do this, obviously with better compensation. Not everybody will step out of their shell, but they can have one-on-one conversations. And yeah, I think that call to action of just having a lot of options to pick from is really the value to the average nurse that engages to recognize that there is a circle of influence that they can engage with. I attended a webinar, and that really, I think, is probably what was the biggest influence, because I don't know, obviously there's a lot of PFAS discussions in general, but I thought there was more meat to that than anything I had experienced previously. I think what it gave me was so much confidence to take it forward in different venues. So the first opportunity I had was in Rome. I was in training, a communications training, a risk communications for public health. And so I'm in this global setting, this internationally attended event. It was two solid weeks for the certificate program. And I just pitched an idea, right? We each had thoughts on what we might want to focus on. And they actually picked my idea. And it is PFAS-centric in that I wanted to develop a communications campaign whereby military families could research and understand their PFAS exposure at military installations, but also the immediately surrounding communities, because obviously water tables don't honor boundaries on the surface, right? So it would have that broader impact. So to my delight, all these people from around the world chose my proposal, and we worked on that communications program together. So that was really encouraging. In August, so that would have happened in July. Then in August, I attended a different certification. It's called Elected Officials to Protect America on Climate Change, EOPA. And that's a public leadership certificate through the University of San Francisco. But these elected officials get together and they coach you on like values-based communications and just techniques for public speaking and how to do the coalition building that you need to advance policy forward. And that was really encouraging. And again, my topic was selected. And these were people, there were many from Ukraine, from the UK, all over the US. And many of them, probably 2/3, are elected officials, right? So I felt like it was really a valuable community for a test case because they were pretty astute. That was, like a 10-week program. And we submitted our proposal on Monday, I think actually the 11th at midnight, whatever, Sunday night. So that's really fresh and recent. But we'll find out there's about $7,500 of grant money, prize money from a philanthropic group that's trying to promote grassroots efforts for the environment. And we'll see how it goes. So all kinds of people. And that was the third time that I pitched my idea, and they took it, they accepted it. And so the concept with them is to continue on a monthly basis. And we have a small, I think our table We had the option when we walked in, just different environmental subjects, if it was air pollution or whatever. And I sat at the water table, right? So I think we have five of us. And we've opted to continue. And I think like layer by layer, this groundwork keeps advancing. So it's really exciting. It's definitely a policy program that we fine tune now that we're up to 20 interested parties.
Thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this important environmental health issue with me today. As a practicing nurse practitioner, I'm looking forward to incorporating Annie's PFAS toolkit in my practice. Thank you to Annie for advocating for these communities and those like them all over the country. And thank you for developing this toolkit. Most especially, thank you for Paloma's insightful comments on her use of the toolkit and how she's used it to propel her work going forward.
Yeah, it's been amazing to hear how Paloma was empowered by our webinar and resources to take action with this PFAS issue.
Thank you to Lika, Christina, and Paloma for an interesting and inspiring conversation about issues with exposures to PFAS and ideas for nursing action to address them. Thank you to Lika Robb and Christina Watkins for hosting the podcast. And thank you all for listening. As a reminder, the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast is 100% non-commercial. We charge nothing and advertise nothing. Please tell others about it. Share with your nursing colleagues, family, and friends. Thank you. Talk to you next time.